Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Spanning more than 250 years, from the mid-18th century to the present, the Albany Institute of History and Art's costume collection includes more than 4,000 garments and accessories that were used or worn by upstate New Yorkers of all ages, social classes, economic conditions, and cultural groups. To celebrate and display some of that collection, they've created the exhibition Well Dressed in Victorian Albany, 19th Century Fashion from the Albany Institute Collection. From wedding gowns to walking suits, the garments featured in the exhibition reflect the changes of style during the reign of the British monarch, Queen Victoria, from 1837 to 1901. Well Dressed in Victorian Albany is on view through May 20th, and curator Diane Shuchuk led me through the show.
Our director, Tamas Groft, said we should do an exhibition about fashion in our collection. And I said, well, why don't I narrow it down to the period of Queen Victoria's reign, because PBS is airing the miniseries about Queen Victoria. So that's how it started. It started about 7 months before the exhibition officially opened.
There are 43 dresses in this exhibition spanning the Victorian era, which is a very long period of time, especially for like a fashion movement, if you think about it. And all of them are owned by the Institute.
Yes, every dress in the exhibition is owned by the Albany Institute. We have dozens and dozens of 19th century garments in our collection, stored right here at the museum in special climate-controlled cabinets or in boxes. If the dress can't be supported on a hanger, it gets boxed. So yes, everything on view is owned by us.
And how did you select what would be put out for the show?
I went through each cabinet one by one and looked at each dress and looked at its condition to decide whether it could withstand being put on a mannequin, whether the sleeve could support having a mannequin arm push through it, whether it was fit the themes I was working on. I was working on individual themes so that each section of the gallery would have a specific time period to focus on. So whether it was the Civil War era, I was picking out dresses to represent that stylistic time in fashion history, or whether it was the 1890s and the Gilded Age. So I just created a checklist of maybe 50 or 60 dresses and then started to figure out how much space they would take up in the galleries. And if I had enough of each to represent a particular style, whether it was a bustle or a crinoline, and kept narrowing it down to narrow it down to 43 dresses that complemented each other, that worked well together on a platform and told a story.
How do the dresses, and I'm sure there's various tales, become part of the Albany Institute's collection? Does the owner donate them at some point, or how do they get here?
Yeah, almost every dress in this exhibition was donated to us, with the exception of one that we purchased because it was owned by Augusta Kirtland Genet, who came from a very famous sort of colonial family, the Genets, who came to this country from France. The others were donated to us, and oftentimes these dresses were saved for sentimental reasons. There are six wedding gowns in the exhibition, and people can't get rid of wedding gowns. They often call us, and we access them and decide whether we can add another one to the collection. But they were all donated to us, probably over a period of 120 years.
To get them all on the mannequins, I understand, was quite a thing. How do you get the mannequins and make these dresses that were made for a specific person's body a number of years ago ready to be on display here?
So this is actually working opposite. Usually you fit the dress to the body. In this case, we had to fit the body to the dress. So we invested for the first time and purchased about 50 dress mannequins that were in the petite size. And these are styrofoam bodies that are covered only hip length, covered in a cotton jersey, and which then I had to actually sculpt each body to get it down to 19 inches or up to 26 inches. Using an electric turkey knife, we actually had to shave and carve the styrofoam away from the waistlines and oftentimes the bust lines to get it down to fit these small dresses. So an electric turkey knife. So in a sense, in my dressing room, I set up a room at the museum in our lecture hall that became the dressing room. So I had a sewing room where I was making petticoats. I also had a carving station. So this gave the word carving station a different kind of meaning, because I was carving styrofoam instead of turkeys and hams with the same kind of knife. And then I had a steaming station to steam the dresses.
Let's talk about some of them specifically. Where do you want to begin?
Oh, I love them all. People always ask me what my favorite is, and my favorite was always the one I was working on at that moment. I'm more apt to tell you what I didn't like about some. Many of these are high couture. They're made in Paris for elite women that lived in the capital region. So I often gravitate first towards the ones made by the House of Worth, who's a very famous fashion house in Paris. or Wirth and Boberg, when Charles Frederick Wirth had a partner named Otto Boberg, because the craftsmanship on those French dresses is unlike anything you see, because it is couture. So the inside is as finished as the outside, and the elaborate trims are so amazingly constructed that you can't imagine to know how many pieces it took to create a dress. So let's start with the earliest one, which is not a French dress, but the earliest dress in the collection is in 1842, in this exhibition, not in our collection, because we go back to the 18th century, is an 1842 wedding gown that is the most amazing surviving example of a pearl. The silk has this pearl-esque sheen to it, and it's a damask that was then embroidered with these floral sprigs all over it, and then assembled with these amazing pleats around the V-shaped neckline with these buttons that are self-covered in the same fabric. And it's the most elegant thing, I feel, because of its it looks deceptively simple, but it's really not that simple. And it's got metal stays in the bodice to keep her on the body in a specifically rigid kind of way. But the fact that this has survived is really a miracle. And then I love, people are surprised when they come to this exhibition about the amount of color that they see. So in the hallway, we have six wedding gowns. The one I just described is a wedding gown. But we have also two wedding gowns that are, one is green and one is claret colored, because women often wore their Sunday best. The wearing of white Victorian wedding gowns was sort of popularized by Queen Victoria. But before then, and still after then, women wore their Sunday best. They couldn't always afford to buy a new dress. So we have very vibrant colored dresses in this exhibition that always surprise people, from fuchsias to cerulean blues to purples. And we tried to come up with clever names for things, but it was really hard, because when you read the period literature and you look at fashion descriptions, they'll say Metternich pink and Dagmar green, and you don't know what that means today. Those are Queen Victoria's friends, and so colors were named after them. Kind of like Benjamin wore pink colors now. You don't always know what they mean. But I think the dresses, and I love the detail. I mean, I love the fussiness of them. I love that each hemline has a lot of detail going on. So the woman would have had to have the right undergarment when she tried these on in Paris to come back to this country and not have to hem it up anymore or lengthen it. These are in miraculously great condition. We do have more in storage that aren't so great, but these have virtually no stains on them. The families that cared for these really, really cared for these and preserved them. And we always tell people, as a friend says, never store something you love like this where you wouldn't put grandma. So if you wouldn't put grandma in the attic or the basement, don't put your Victorian wedding dress in the attic or the basement.
You mentioned that the undergarments have to sit a certain way for the dress to look right, as the designer and the dressmaker intended. How did you make sure that you were doing that right for the show?
Well, we don't have 40 sets of undergarments in our collection, because think about it, would you give your underwear to a museum? So oftentimes, the underwear comes to us from as part of a bridal trousseau or something, and so we just don't have enough of it. So we had to reconstruct things with modern materials to create the proper silhouette. So oftentimes, during the bustle period, which would have had a steel bustle on the back of a woman's body, kind of on her butt, made out of steel or horsehair or rattan, there were a number of ways to make bustles. I recreated a lot of that using Ziploc bags and packing peanuts, which then I could fill up as much as I needed to fill up and then layer them on top of another, because sometimes the bustle was a shelf-like bustle, very horizontal. Sometimes it dropped a little lower, and sometimes even lower, or there was a small pad. So I found that the packing peanut system worked the best. Because the dresses had to move so many times from where I dressed them to a photography area to a holding area, while we built the platforms and created the gallery surrounds, everything had to be attached to these mannequin bodies so that nothing would fall out. There's no bubble wrap or tissue underneath these. I actually spent hours stitching ruffles, soft ruffles, hard ruffles, ruffles made out of netting or old bed sheets. And then we sometimes use contemporary modern hoops that we manipulated to fit the shape of what the dress was. The dress talks to me. You know, the dresses speak to me when I look at them, so I kind of know what they want to be in the end and what silhouette they're trying to be. And I have to say the costumer in Schenectady was invaluable to us, because they lent us their head draper and designer to come two mornings a week, so that when I had to manipulate mass volumes of fabric, because there's no way that one person can manipulate the amount of fabric in these skirts or dresses, Helen Porter would come from the costumer to help me figure out what that shape was supposed to be on the ones that had the huge crinolines or the very challenging heavy fabrics that I couldn't do on my own.
So why do you know how to sew ruffles?
I was just always, when I was a Russell Sage student as an undergrad, I worked in the theater department. So as one of my work study programs, and I have always known how to sew. I don't know how. I'm very crafty that way. I can make lots of craft projects. So sewing ruffles was just, it just was kind of therapeutic in so many ways. Just stitching yards, endless, I think I used 30 yards of netting, and I was always running up to the fabric store to buy more. It just comes naturally to me. It's not something that's I don't want to sew endless zippers, but I don't mind making ruffles.
Well, let's talk about another dress. Where should we go?
So let's see. We have a great dress. When you first walk into the gallery, we have a dress that was probably, when I use the term fancy dress, people might think it's Sunday best, but when I say fancy dress during the Victorian era, it means it was worn at a fancy dress occasion where the hostess of the event you're attending may have chosen a theme, and you would have dressed as your theme. So in this case, there is a major dress on view by the House of Worth, made in Paris again, for Augusta Kirtland Genet, and it's a beautiful brocade with a floral pattern on it, of a creamy kind of, it's the softest fabric in the show, kind of dusty rose with layers of lace on top of it, with a lilac pattern that's three-dimensional, and with the a bodice that is laced up the front. And we feel, and I feel, that this was made for a fancy dress party of some kind. And the theme may have been, we think she's trying to be a shepherdess.
Okay.
So in the colonial era, when it was romanticized, and you thought, when you look at our porcelain figurines of this period, you see that women dressed as shepherdesses, a la Marie Antoinette, in these fanciful garments, not what real shepherdesses would have worn. So we think she was trying to be a shepherdess. And so this is, in a sense, this indeed is a costume worn for a fancy dress occasion. That's hard for us to imagine today, but the theme could have been flowers or gardening or something. So that is a special dress that's in the entry because she doesn't really fit any other theme, but I thought she was so spectacularly crazy that she deserved to be in the show.
Well, it's so complicated compared to, I mean, the most complicated thing I've ever worn was my wedding dress, and it is nothing. It was nothing compared to this. It was lovely, but this is so many bits, like, assembled gorgeously.
Yeah, no, and we wanted people to understand, so we got a shepherd's crook from the costumer to sort of help tell that story for people to understand this was indeed not an everyday garment. Indeed, most of the dresses on exhibition were worn by Albany and the Capital Region's elite members of society, like the Corning family members or others, or the Livingstons or Stuyvesants, but not, we do have a nice collection of everyday wear, but the theme of this exhibition, as our big debut costume exhibition, was to show masterpieces of design, construction, kind of like our Thomas Cole's and Frederick Church's. You know, that this is the equivalent of that, but in a different medium. So it's a high-end couture.
This show has been extended due to popular demand. That's not an overstatement, I don't think, to say it's been very well received. Did that surprise you?
It did surprise me because I think people come to us to see our mummies and to see our Hudson River School collection. And I know that as a costume enthusiast myself, I will drive a few hours to see a costume exhibition. And I think we found that same here when I read our guest book, and I love our guest book. People from New Jersey come here, or Connecticut, or Massachusetts, because it's very rare that you have an opportunity to see an exhibition of Victorian clothing this up close and personal. There are no walls of glass or plexiglass in front of these dresses. And I think everyone relates to clothing. You have a sentimental attachment to it. You don't always relate to a silver tea set or a pewter tankard, but you relate to a dress you wore or your child's first outfit. And there are three children's outfits in this exhibition.
All right. We could probably talk about one or two more things if I could force you to choose.
Sure. So I want to talk about a whole scene that I did in one of the galleries. So there are little scenes throughout. There's a little Venetian scene and a Civil War scene and a Washington Park scene where there are mannequins pushing a stroller, a pram, basically, a baby carriage. And in this one small gallery, I wanted to create the scene of when Victoria and Albert, there's a very famous print of Victoria and Albert around a tabletop Christmas tree in the 1840s or early 1850s. And I wanted to recreate that in a small gallery so that people could see what surrounded these dresses. What you would have sat on when you wore a dress from the 1850s, what kinds of things would have decorated your walls, what kinds of chairs the child would have sat in, what the Christmas tree looked like. And this was over the holiday period when this exhibition debuted in October through Christmas. So there's a tabletop Christmas tree here that I have to admit I bought at IKEA, but we made the decorations because we didn't have Victorian decorations. They would have been homemade at the day. And we chose to put three children in the scene, I did, and they're wearing plaid because Victoria acquires Balmoral Castle in the Scottish Highlands, and everybody goes crazy for plaid and tartan. So you'll see that the three children's garments in this part of the exhibition are wearing plaid. And then there's two adult women and an adult male garment in this exhibition, in this particular gallery. So it really creates like a Victorian parlor scene that's a whole suite of objects to tell a bigger story. So I think it's one of the first things you see when you walk in the exhibition, and I think it draws you into that space to understand the portraits they would have lived with, mixed in with a needlework picture that the woman of the house may have made next to a wreath that's made out of yarn that would have also hung in the home. So it's a nice mixture of formal portraits and landscapes and yet women, examples of women's work.
It's very charming.
Oh, so we have a really great, so that goes from the 1850s. We're going to jump to the Gilded Age of the 1890s. So I think that is a nice bookend to this, even though we have dress garments, walking suits that go up to 1901, which are very elegant, classically styled. They look simple, but they're not. But in one corner of the gallery, I have two dresses from the Gilded Age. And I always think of Edith Wharton when I look at these dresses. And both are examples of leg of mutton sleeves, which is really based on the shape of the hind leg of a sheep.
I see that now that you say it. I never would have thought of that before. But you're right. It's a big puffy sleeve with the thick part of the leg on the shoulder.
Exactly.
And it tapers to the elbow.
So this was in style for a very short period of time in the 1890s, and we have two examples. Well, we have four in the gallery, but two in this particular Gilded Age scene. So there's this amazingly, a brocade that is the heaviest dress in the show, with these two-piece dress with a beaded fringe trim, with gilded threads throughout the entire brocade. And so we had our designer light her a certain way, so she really sort of sparkles. Mm-hmm. And it's a golden corner because to me that's, I love like Stattsburg and you know, Edith Wharton's house. And I love all these sort of Gilded Age houses in Newport. And so she sort of epitomizes that to me. And the dress next to her is by Callot Soeur. So a group of sisters that opened a French couture house. And this is early for them. So this is a lace cover dress, still with a sort of leg of mutton sleeve, but not as prominent as the brocade. And then they're both in tones of gold and kind of honey-colored amber. So they're very soft, but they really make a statement of beauty, luxury. And these are both dresses that have labels, designer labels in them, one from France and one from New York City. So, and then I've surrounded them with, I've chosen paintings from our collection from this time period that have a golden glow to them to sort of really emphasize. One has a golden mat by Walter Lump, both are by Walter Lump Palmer, both are in all the things that surround the dresses are in our collection. So it's fun to sort of decorate the scenes that I set up in each corner of the galleries.
It's really beautiful and interesting, and I thank you so much for your time and your enthusiasm.
Well, thanks for stopping by, Sarah.
The exhibition Well-Dressed in Victorian Albany, 19th Century Fashion from the Albany Institute Collection is on view at the Albany Institute of History and Art through May 20th. For more information, including details on special events related to the exhibition, visit albanyinstitute.org. That link will be posted along with this segment at wamc.org/roundtable.